As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keen, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Let's get to the market conversation with Ben Laidler, global market strategist at eToro. Ben, in your work, we see some hope this bond route may be easing. This is a key ingredient for any equity recovery. Before we get to talking about whether this is positive or not for risk assets, can you tell me why you think bond yields may well be peaking this time?
I think it's difficult to see real yields just continuing to head to the moon at a time when all your inflation lead indicators are rolling over, where recession risks are spiking. I think the disconnect is in there, and I think given where real and nominal yields got to, and on the flip side, given where valuations and sentiment have got to, I think that risk reward setup is very, very interesting.
Ben, given that, if the Fed is going to retrace some of its pretty hawkish statements, what does that mean in terms of earnings? We've heard this from Mike Wilson. We've heard this from Mohamed El-Erian, that be careful what you wish for, because if the Fed does retrace, that means that things are really bad and we have not priced that in.
I think this is, to your earlier comment, this feels a little bit like Groundhog Day, right? I think the setup is very similar to where we were before the big sort of June rally. I think the market is sniffing out the sort of top of the Fed cycle. I think bond yields have overshot and are now coming down. And I think, to your point on earnings, we're going into third quarter earnings season where, yet again, expectations are very, very negative.
Yeah.
And I think this is an attractive setup. I think we're just going to leap over this sort of low bar and breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief.
Ben, I want to go to your huge track record on three cycles of getting the market right. And I want to go to Lisa's gloom yesterday. I want to go to nodes of revenue guesses. What it comes down to is, with a slowing economy, everybody's going to try to guess revenues at the top line. Given all the economic mumbo jumbo, what are the nodes of revenue guesses is going to do?
I think this is all sort of fear versus reality. I think markets, I mean, we're down 25%. Earnings expectations have actually fallen quite a lot, I would argue. And not all recessions are created equal. I mean, granted, we're almost certainly going into a recession, at least outside of Asia. But this is not 2007. This is not 2020. This is, I think, a much more plain vanilla, central bank-driven recession. And I think that is, given where we are, I think that's actually pretty investable. That's a 2 percentage point GDP peak to trough fall. That's a 14% decline in earnings expectations, where I think you're at least halfway there. Again, I think where markets and sentiment and valuations are at this point, I think the bigger risk is being out, not in.
Okay, so Ben, given all of that, just quickly here, how much are you buying with your conviction? I mean, basically, are you loading up the truck?
I think we're building a bottom, right? I think this is a U-shaped recovery, not a V. I think the Fed has told us quite clearly that, you know, they're going to stay the course until something breaks. Well, hey, stuff may be starting to break. We don't need the top of the Fed cycle. We just need a little bit of visibility that it may be coming in the next sort of 4 or 5 months. And the Fed's just not going to keep hiking here. I think all the lead indicators are telling that. So I'm comfortable enough saying we're building a bottom. So I'm fully invested. I'm certainly tilted a bit more to the defensives. You know, risks are still pretty high, but I'm absolutely nibbling at that sort of quality risk, that sort of big tech, you know, discounted small caps. I mean, the more this goes on, the closer we get to inflation definitively coming down. I think you want to be, you're raising the risk budget into that.
Ben Laidler, thank you, sir, of eToro.
Jordan Rochester would probably get on me. Birmingham?
Birmingham.
I did okay.
Hey, Jordan's a hometown boy from Birmingham, yeah.
Jordan Rochester joins us now from Birmingham right now, G10FX Strategy at Nomura. Jordan, I want to go to the news of the day, which is the Bank of Australia blinked. There's no question about that. Maybe it's a new trend, maybe it's not. If the banks start blinking like they did in Canberra? Canberra. And Canberra, what does that mean for foreign exchange? What does that mean for your call on the dollar?
I think that's everything, Tom. Are we going to have more central banks blink? When it comes to the RBA, it stands out as one of the central banks with a mortgage market where most mortgages are variable, they're floating. So they do react to what's happening in rates markets today, in those housing markets for everybody, not just the marginal house purchaser. Where in the US with 10-year, 30-year fixes, in the UK with 2 and 5, in Europe with 10-year fixes, the impact of these rate hikes comes through with a different lag. In the UK, it's faster. In the US, it's much slower. And of course, the marginal buyer sets the price. So even in the US, your last guest was talking about the slowdown in house prices. But I think when it comes to the Fed, when it comes to other central banks, they're still going to be looking at inflation nowhere near their targets. But what's going on right now in markets is people are asking the question, oh, are we going to listen to what the Bank of England experienced last week? Will the Fed, will the ECB think twice about what they're doing just in case we have a financial contagion risk that's building up with rates moving as quickly as they are? So I think right now it's all about mood music rather than actual action from anyone like the Fed or the ECB. I think central banks will still be hawkish. Inflation will still be stronger than they want. But right now we're in that sort of quiet space where we're all thinking, is the UK and is the RBA, are they both canary in the coal mine sort of situation?
Jordan, I sense you're skeptical. So are you fading this move? Is that what you're recommending to clients?
I think you mentioned a 10% move, and rule 101, and I kind of broke that, is don't chase flash crashes. And basically that's what we had in sterling after the mini budget. Huge moves, 5% moves lower. Typically, when you have that, everybody gets very convinced it's the right trade, becomes very consensus, and then policymakers react, and then you have mean reversion on that reaction, and that's what's happened. But in the UK's case, the reaction's been really timid. So just reducing the top rate tax from the 45 pence tax costs nothing, really. It's £2 billion. We're talking £100 billion for the energy package overall over its lifetime. So this £2 billion is a rounding error for fiscal sustainability. So for me, this is all about mood music. The UK is showing that perhaps they're not going to be as zealous when it comes to fiscal policymaking. Mm-hmm. But if you take the facts as they are, everything's the same apart from that £2 billion of spending. So I am skeptical, John. And I also think core inflation in the US will remain stickier than what all of our leading indicators for headline inflation signals. Because commodity prices are softer, everyone says peak inflation. I agree with that. But core inflation will be stronger than you think. Because look at job openings in the US. They're just ridiculously high. And they're not falling enough to say that we're having a weaker labor market. So this all feeds into the Fed not being happy where things are. And this softness in US yields, I don't think it will last.
So, Jordan, we were talking to Tom Tsitsouris of Strategus, a Baird company, earlier, and he was talking about how the price action that you've seen in 10-year treasuries and 2-year treasuries indicates stability, indicates price discovery in a way that we have not seen in years. Is the same true for your FX market, with the pound rallying 10% off an incredible swoon?
I think most of that is poor liquidity, positioning in sterling being very one way. And then we had the rebalancing of month end. And we've got to remember as well, this pension situation meant that the amount of flows going through in the UK were huge. So it's kind of hard to say that, is this a fundamental price discovery that's going on? Or is this just everybody being one way and pensions being bailed out by the Bank of England's QE program, which comes to an end in less than 2 weeks? So we have to watch out for that cliff edge. What happens to the UK rates market once that QE program comes to an end? I think price discovery is still in effect. The US has everything the world needs. It has oil, it has LNG exports. The Europeans don't have either of those things. And a key difference, when they imported that natural gas from Russia, it was priced in euros. Not anymore. It's in LNG, it's in dollars. So there's a fundamental terms of trade shift that points to euro being at 90 cents by the end of this year.
Jordan, let me make clear, and I'm not trying to sell Nomura on this, but when the LDI scandal was breaking, I used a Nomura research report from 2018. Jordan, it was scary accurate about what the mess would be in the British pension market. Jordan, where's the trade opportunity right now? I mean, where's the big figure opportunity right now, everything considered?
I think where we are today, I think we've got this dollar softness thanks to lower US yields. It's backed up by mood music, the ISM being weaker, potential for China having this marathon and masks being taken off for that marathon, all kind of mood music stuff, not fundamental game changers. We've got NFP coming up on Friday. I suspect we'll have a strong average hourly earnings number. I think the jobs data will still hold up, the growth on that side. So I think folks will be surprised again by US jobs not slowing down as they expect from all the growth signals we have. And then we've got CPI the week after. So I think really the trade is to fade this dollar weakness. It looks like everything we saw in May, it looks like what we saw in August. We had these kind of big drawdowns in the long dollar trade, but the trend is still there. So euro to 90, cable to parity and below.
Jordan, can you just congratulate Tom for saying Birmingham and not Birmingham?
I'm working.
We've been working on this, Jordan.
Working on it.
Right. Next is the Brummie accent, so if he can say, "You're right, mate."
I
want to go up to You've the Plough and Harborne and have a true full English. English up there is different.
That was
than
an authentic Brummie accent you
it
got
was,
just
it's
then
very authentic.
From Jordan Rochester of Nomura.
It's a real
Jordan. Thank you.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Right now, she has one of the greatest parchment streams in the United Kingdom, from Edinburgh to London School of Economics, with real expertise on China. The chief economist, T.S. Lombard. Freya Bamish joins us right now. Freya, just to start, are we in global recession?
I think we're heading that way. I don't think we're quite there in the U.S. China's probably coming out of its recession, but still very weak and not really going to get its reopening boost until H1 of next year. The real problem is Europe, and I think this is what's moving markets at the moment as well. That there's something much wider going on here than just the kind of the. If I can use the term slightly cack-handed, delivery of the fiscal policy response in the UK.
I look, Freya, at the news flow, and clearly Australia blinking is important. What are the ramifications for other central banks, including ECB, that RBA just decides enough?
Yeah, I think what's happening here is that there's a global shift towards a higher returns environment, but you can't get there all in one go. The real economy just can't handle it, and there are these sort of powder kegs of financial accelerators that have been left behind by the period of low yields in the 2010s. So trying to get from the 2010s level of yields to a pre-global financial crisis level of yields, which is where we think we ultimately will be ending up over the 2020s, trying to do that in one mini cycle, which is the COVID COVID cycle is just too much for the real economy and for financial markets. So I think what we start to see now is that QE comes back in a very different guise from how it did in the 2010s. It's much more of the sort of the Badgett response to try to provide liquidity where necessary in order to prevent yields from rising more rapidly rather than to try to keep yields from shifting lower. And I think the underlying forces here are much, much wider than the kind of the narrative, at least around the UK, suggests. What's happening here is that there's been a redirection of funds in favor of the energy firms, in favor of Russia, really, and the non-fossil fuel firms. And what that does is you're handing funds to companies and countries that are much more likely to want to invest them than they were in the recipients of those funds in the 2010s.
Well, Freya,
and in that process, you're dragging yields higher.
There's a lot there. And I want to just hone in on one thing that you said, that quantitative easing this time around is going to look very different. Does that mean that you think that quantitative tightening's over and that we're entering a new quantitative easing cycle of trying to reduce the pace of bond yield increases?
I think in as far as the UK goes, yes, I would say that quantitative easing is sort of dead before it gets off the ground.
Quantitative tightening.
Quantitative tightening. Thank you. The quantitative tightening just doesn't really get off the ground. That you get this kind of QE that is not the same flavor as the 2010s, and it's there to prevent yields from rising too rapidly. And that is probably the case for Europe as well, where we're if anything more worried than we are about the UK, with Germany already having suggested that they're going to go it alone on the fiscal front. Where does that leave countries like Italy, where we'd be much more worried about those kind of structural issues starting to re-arise in the euro area. Therefore, you get the move back to the TPI, which can very easily translate into something similar to what the Bank of England is doing with regards to its kind of short-term new flavor QE. So it's a very different flavor of monetary policy since the 2010s.
How much is this a European story and how much is this a global story? I mean, Tom was talking about the RBA blinking, raising just 25 basis points rather than a bigger rate hike that was expected overnight. How much is this the example rather than a story of specific nations facing specific inflationary pressures?
I think there are now so many different idiosyncratic problems that are arising at the same time that we can say that something systemic is actually going on. The European trouble, Europe is definitely at the center of this. I would definitely point out problems in China that can arise perhaps not till after the reopening, so therefore into the second half of next year. But I would definitely point that out as structural turning points for China as well. And I think because of this kind of updraw in yields that fiscal authorities are very much leaning against. You've got this battle for funds that really speaks to the longer term secular trends that have just been sort of fast forwarded by this energy shock, that deterioration of the geopolitical environment and the natural environment. These are all factors that are kind of nasty cost push inflation factors that speak to the need for higher returns and the likelihood of higher returns in the 2020s. And we're just seeing the fast forwarding of that in the short term. But I think it does lead to capitulation from central banks, first in the form of pushing back against the financial accelerators, as we've seen in the UK in the pension funds fiasco. But then in the case of Europe, as a result of the slowdown in growth, yes, governments are supporting their economies through fiscal spending, but that the cost of doing that, there's no free lunch, the cost of doing that is that yields are much higher. So you're getting the spending on energy, but it's happening at a higher yields, and therefore the property market in the UK and yields more broadly are starting to tighten financial conditions and tamp down on growth in that fashion. So central banks turn from worrying about inflation in Europe to worrying about the financial accelerators and then growth, and therefore you get the capitulation in that sense. I think in the US we are in a very different position here because inflation is more embedded, and therefore the policy response has to be still focused on inflation.
And this is the heritage of T.S. Lombard, Freya. I mean, model out how they get to 2%, given that a huge body of people say that's an impossible event? Do you just assume they get to 5% or 4% and then recalibrate?
I think that's probably where we're getting to further down the line, that they will eventually explicitly or implicitly revert inflation targets higher, just because there are so many secular forces that are pointing in favor of higher inflation, and not all of them being kind of cost push inflation. There's also this change in the relationship in global labor markets and credit as well, that suggests that China is no longer a cap on wage growth in developed markets. Therefore, you have faster wage growth. You also have faster credit growth, and both of those things are inflationary. So leaning against that means you're kind of accepting this politically unacceptable idea of a much higher unemployment rate in order to get inflation back down again. But I think in the shorter term with the Fed, the point that I would get across is that there's too much reliance on leading indicators that are simply monitoring what the costs are doing, and that the demand-supply imbalance in the US, both in terms of the goods market, still both in terms of the labor market, is still great enough that you've got this underlying heat in demand in the economy, and therefore while the rest of the world has good prospects for a slowdown in inflation, I'm still worried that you get upside surprises in inflation in the US because margins have greater room to expand on the back of demand still remaining relatively strong. So we're very much looking out for that U.S. recession coming through, because that's the kind of the key turning point for the Fed. But it doesn't seem like we're quite there yet.
Freya, thank you for being with us this morning. Freya Beamish of TS Lombard, just absolutely brilliant.
It is October, which means we must speak with Paul
just
Sankey, founder and lead analyst at Sankey Research, who's ignoring this conversation. Paul Sankey has decades of experience in oil and knows in October there is Vienna, and there's also Park Lane, a string of hotels in London where the elite meet to greet in the oil community, as they do beginning today. It is the energy executive of the year is from Qatar. We'll pass on that, but far more CEOs together and the rest. Paul, is a consensus opinion that oil will rise back into the hundreds?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the first consensus is that we'll get a million barrel a day cut from OPEC tomorrow, and what people here are saying will be a brief meeting. I was told that the decision's already taken. I was actually hoping that they would take some time and argue a bit so I'd get a chance to get out to Vienna towards the end of the week, but evidently the decision will come tomorrow. That should be, I think, a million barrel a day cut. We've got about half of that probably, Tom, actually delivered. But it's still enough to tighten what's effectively a market imbalance in Q4. So any cut will effectively serve to raise prices.
The elite meet to greet at the Intercontinental Hotel or at the Dorchester with umbrellas in their drink. But is it just about Saudi Arabia and Russia?
Well, I have to say I've got to wear black tie tonight for the award dinner. Tom, I need your help with the bow tie there. But we had the CEO of Aramco talking very eloquently. Ben Van Beurden of Shell also very eloquent. We had protesters outside the Intercontinental yelling in my ear as I walked in. But the problem is the protesters don't really have a coherent solution. In fact, nobody does. And that's one of the issues. A couple of interesting points from Shell, for instance. He said that this quarter alone, China is adding more coal production than in the entirety of Shell's energy production. So essentially in one quarter, China grows coal by the entire size of Shell. And again, talking about the CEO of Aramco, again, talking about lack of spare capacity and how demand is remaining strong. Well, so again, further to your first question, it's all pointing towards higher prices, basically.
And that's really the crux of the matter. How much is this potential cut of a million barrels really an issue of a lack of capacity rather than the appearance of lack of demand? And how much pushback will OPEC Plus get from the United States, from Europe, saying, we need lower prices at this point to stave off a crisis? Why are you effectively causing an increase in prices or potentially laying the groundwork for that going forward?
Well, Lucy, you made a great point, which I'll come back to. But firstly, I think the Saudis have enjoyed $100 oil and, you know, would rather we were closer to 100 than to 80. So that's point one. Point two that you made is that they're so tight on spare capacity that they may well feel that, you know, to rest their fields a bit, to give themselves some more breathing room, a cut is a good thing. The outside chance was that there'd be a major quota renegotiation, but it doesn't sound like that's happening. These guys are still using 2018 quotas, which are just completely nonsensical now in terms of things like Nigeria and Angola, just not even close to their quotas. But I don't think there's going to be that kind of agreement. I think it'll be a pretty strong cut decision led by Saudi, UAE.
15-minute meeting?
Of course, we've got the other interests. We've got Russia.
15 minutes or more for this meeting?
More than 15, I think. You know, those ones were just rubber stamps. But it may be, I think, well, I was hoping it would take longer than a day and roll into Thursday, Friday. It sounds like we'll get a decision tomorrow. And before the markets in the US tomorrow, yeah, could be.
There we go. Paul Sankey, thank you, sir. Good to see you. Paul Sankey there of Sankey Research.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.